What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
It's Wednesday, but we're going to pretend like it's Monday and get in our full live hour Palestine post. We were a pre-recorded show on Monday due to Indigenous Peoples Day. It has been 738 days since October 7, 2023, and in that time, the Gaza Health Ministry has reported that at least 67,938 Palestinians have been murdered. 170,169 people have been reported as wounded. Since the ceasefire, the so-called ceasefire, and my guests are about to get into that, Israel has continued to attack Palestinians in Gaza. 9 were murdered yesterday. 25 bodies at hospitals have arrived in the last 24 hours. 16 bodies recovered from rubble and one person who died from their injuries. And the promised aid is slow to arrive, with some pathways not even opened yet. Joining us to discuss is the homie Samer Arabi, a member of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, or AROC, who also co-hosts the weekly Palestine Solidarity Announcements every Friday at noon. Hi, Samer. How are you?
Hey, Kat. Always great to be here.
Good to be with you, too. I'm trying to adjust the rate people on the air don't know, but we're on a TV camera. I've got these weird things shooting out of my head. Oh, well, I guess we're just going to have special effects for this show. Samer, there's so much to talk about, but I want to walk through the 20 points, because I would bet money that the vast majority of the people that are listening don't know what's in the 20 points they're hearing. There's this 20-point peace plan. I have axed the word peace out of that sentence. I mean, some of them I think we'll spend time on. Some of them I think, we can sort of move through. They're self-explanatory. But there's some nonsensical things in there that I think are really important for us to pull out. So I'm going to pull that up as we are. Yeah, right here. Here it is. Okay. All right. Here is Trump's proposal verbatim, and I'm pulling this from the AP. 1, Gaza will be a de-radicalized, terror-free zone that does not pose a threat to its neighbors. He's laughing. Those who can't hear it, Sam was laughing. I think I laughed too. Your verbal response.
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be great if Gaza was a de-radicalized, terror-free zone? Because the radicals enforcing terror all through Gaza is obviously the IDF. Like, the ones who are literally committing acts of terrorism every day, including into this cessation of hostilities, has been the Israeli forces. You know, and you're dealing with a population that overwhelmingly supports the genocide that is happening in Gaza and seems to have no problems with it, but not a single word about the de-radicalization of Israelis, right? It's the idea that Palestinians who have been suffering under this, relentless horror for 2 years now somehow also need to be psychologically retrained to be okay with the status quo. It's a horror.
2, and I don't think we or other people have spent enough time actually sitting in what this means, or that this is actually what Trump's really good at, the one thing he can do. Gaza will be redeveloped for the benefit of the people of Gaza, who have suffered more than enough. I want to put that in the context of Trump will be leading the transitional government, and we've already seen literal plans. Like, there's little AI commercials for the new Gaza City, which look a little bit like Atlantic City, if you ask me.
Trump Gaza, yeah.
The Trump Gaza. So your response to number 2.
I mean, one thing that I feel like is important in terms of context setting is that the so-called 20-point plan, which used to be a 21-point plan before Netanyahu sort of chopped it up, has not been agreed to, right? Like, the agreement that was made between Hamas and the Israelis and mediated by the Americans and the other parties to the mediation process only agreed to the cessation of hostilities, the exchange of political prisoners, the withdrawal of Israeli troops, and the provision of aid. So, like, the actual text of what they agreed to is not the 20-point plan. So we don't, technically that isn't the thing that is agreed to be implemented yet. And secondly, what they did agree to is actually not known to anybody. The text of the agreement is private. And there have been some leaks, so we've seen a few pieces here and there, but not the entire agreement. But the basis of it is, of course, that, it's supposed to lead to these phase 2, phase 3 of the negotiations that ostensibly, and you know, this isn't really, this is one of these like weird, we're living in this very strange liminal space where everyone is pretending that the 20-point plan is going to be like the basis for what that's going to be. But we actually don't know that, right? And it's very clear to me, at least, that Hamas has not agreed to that. And I don't think that they will. And I think a key piece of that, as you mentioned, is this idea of what the so-called redevelopment of Gaza would look like. And it's, you know, I think it's obvious to anyone who's seen the way that this country has comported itself for the past, I don't know, few decades now in this like neoliberal hell that we found ourselves in, that when we talk about reconstruction, what we're really talking about is just a giant cash grab from a few private corporations, right, that are going to get billions of dollars in reconstruction funding with a bunch of like hyped up nonsense tech language about some AI city that has whatever, you know, like special trade, blah, 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 that, you know, we've heard that language before, and it doesn't actually produce anything. What's going to end up happening is nothing, right? Like, there's going to be a bunch of money that's just going to vanish. They're going to do some really basic reconstruction type activities, but nothing near the scale of the investment that's going to go in. And this is, you know, before moving back to the Bay Area, you know, that's what I was working on. It was stabilization assistance into Syria, seeing how like the U.S. government, this was under Obama, was spending, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars on reconstruction assistance. And like, what did they ever, you know, that money would just vanish, right, into a series of private contractors that would then build one rickety house and then be like, look, you know, you're like, okay, you've spent $80 million and all you've managed to do is like build housing for 12 people. So unless there's real Palestinian sovereignty here, right, unless they actually have control over the way that the territory that they inhabit, that they control, that is their homeland, and they have some say in how that actually gets redirected and where that money goes and if there's transparency and oversight. In the absence of that, like, we're not going to solve the underlying issue here. And that relates to, I think, the underlying problem of the genocide, right? Even if the direct fighting ends, even if the drone strikes, the mass displacement, the ethnic cleansing stops, which, by the way, is a huge if, right? We've seen a dozen or so Palestinians killed since the ceasefire was signed. But even if that's the case, the genocide doesn't stop just because the violence, the like explicit violence stops because Israel has rendered Gaza unlivable. Right? And so like, unless there is a concerted effort to make it livable again, then it's death by a thousand cuts for the Palestinians who are stuck there with no social services and no infrastructure.
And let's not forget, Samer, I mean, and not that you would forget, but I'm going to remind my audience, in addition to the explicit violence, right, of bombing and people just being gunned down trying to get food, there's some people that are in the final stages of starving to death, in the middle stages of starving to death, and in the early stages of starving to death. Middle and end are probably going to die. That's just what's real, particularly given the intense medical care that's needed for folks at those stages. Maybe the folks on the earth, but we're talking about hundreds of people that are still going to die as a result of Israel's action. Yeah?
Yeah, hundreds is, you know, I'm sorry to say, a really optimistic assessment. And, you know, I think folks don't fully appreciate is that at those stages of starvation, you can't actually give those people food, right? Giving people food at that level of acute malnutrition would actually kill them. So the level of care that's required is something that's totally not available. But even in terms of basic service provision or like basic humanitarian aid, you know, the deal that was just inked, right? Like what we do know about what the agreement that was made this last week was, you know, with the exchange of hostages and whatnot, also included Israel being required to let in 600 trucks per day of humanitarian aid, which, by the way, itself is still, it's not enough. But even that, they've now announced, and they apparently just today or yesterday disclosed to the United Nations and humanitarian agencies that they're actually going to limit it to 300. So they've cut the number in half unilaterally, despite the fact that this was the exact thing that they agreed to just a few days prior, right? And again, I think it really speaks to that impunity that they're allowed to sort of, you know, renege on whatever with no consequences. And that should be really chilling for people who are hoping that this ceasefire holds.
I'm going to read just a few more. We don't just have to respond to them. I just want to get through them. So three of both sides agree to this proposal. The war will immediately end. Israeli forces will withdraw to the agreed upon line, which isn't in so-called Israel, by the way. It's still in Gaza, to prepare for a hostage release. All military operations, including aerial and artillery bombardment, will be suspended. That has not happened. Battle lines will remain frozen, blah, blah, blah. Within 72 hours of Israel publicly accepting this agreement, all hostages alive and deceased will be returned. That is in process. Little by slow. Once the hostages released, Israel released 250 life sentence prisoners plus 700 people from Gaza. Linda Sarsour says there's no such thing as the word Gazan. I try not to say that, but mainstream media, she like gets really upset. So, okay, you're shaking your head, yes. Okay, so I'm not going to repeat that on the air because she's one of my heroes. 1,700 people from Gaza who were detained after October 7th, women and children. For every Israeli hostage who remains or released, Israel released the remains of 15 deceased Palestinians. Here's where I think the sticking point is. So I'm going to go back to something you said. Number six, once all hostages are returned, Hamas members who commit to peaceful coexistence and to decommission their weapons will be given amnesty. Members of Hamas who wish to leave Gaza will be provided safe passage to receiving countries. In Al Jazeera this morning, the POV was really interesting as they were talking about how not real. So basically it said, you know, while there's this show of the summit being signed, you know, the thing being signed in Egypt, by the way, which Netanyahu didn't go to, and then Trump speaking at the Knesset, and there's all of these things that are happening. The premise of the short video on Al Jazeera was like behind the scenes, it's much more complicated, right? And things are much more tenuous. So not only has Israel continued to bomb, but Hamas is very much still riding through the streets of Gaza as Hamas. Hamas has not demonstrated that it has any intention of relinquishing its weapons or its power in terms of directing, you know, folks to the degree that it can on the streets in Gaza. So what are we really talking about here?
Yeah, but like this was always going to be a red line, you know, and something that I feel like Hamas has been saying since the very beginning of this, you know, like heightened past 2 years of genocide, is that, you know, that the right of armed resistance is something that is non-negotiable. And I think one thing that they've learned, right, from watching what happened with the Oslo process and, you know, like the Palestinian Authority, the PLO, that basically were like, okay, well, if you put down your ability to do armed resistance, then we'll go down this diplomatic route. And they found themselves years later with both no military resistance and no diplomatic options, right? So I think Hamas learned pretty early on that it's not viable, that they the word of the other interlocutors can't be trusted, which means that renouncing their ability to sort of, you know, like defend themselves militarily means the end of Palestinian resistance to Israeli hegemony, period, right? Like you need that leverage. So it was, you know, even in their initial response to this 20-point plan, right, they specifically avoided that particular piece of it by saying, you know, in the original negotiations, there was talk about like, okay, you know, we're happy to give up offensive weapons capabilities, but our defensive military capability, the ability to defend the Palestinian people from Israeli aggression, like there's no way. And critically, one of the things they said about this is they don't have the right to make that decision on behalf of all Palestinians, right, who all political stripes, right, have the right to resist occupation. This is enshrined in international law, and it's something that's never going to go away. Yeah. So, yeah, this idea of, like, you know, decommissioning, demilitarization is obviously a bit of an Israeli pipe dream that Netanyahu shoved into this process, but you know, it's one of several things, and if we're going to go through the rest of the 20 points, you'll see there's several more where there's just no overlap here, right? Like, between the Israeli position and the Palestinian position, there's just no way that something is going to be agreed upon. So, yeah, it raises some really difficult questions about where this goes.
Okay. Upon acceptance of this agreement, full aid will immediately be sent into the Gaza Strip. At a minimum, it's saying that it was supposed to be consistent, which was included in the January 19th, 2025 agreement, which is, you know, aid coming in, but also rehabilitation of infrastructure, water, electricity, and sewage, hospitals, et cetera. Aid ain't getting in to the degree that it's supposed to. What we agreed to, what was agreed to in January, had nothing to do with it, clearly. What was agreed to in January wasn't enough. And when we're talking about repairing infrastructure of water, electricity, sewage, I mean, people need to remember that they bombed the sewage system. They destroyed the water system. I believe they took out the power lines. Hospitals have been running on generators, and there's basically hallways that managed to survive being repeatedly bombed, surrounded by rubble.
Yeah, and the hospitals are existing on generators using fuel that has now been cut off, right? Like, even the fuel's not getting in. And this is, you know, this is obviously part of the broader Israeli agenda here, right? To render Gaza unlivable means specifically blocking out any of the sort of stabilization, rehabilitation aid. And that's something that they've been doing consistently, right? One of the things we saw from the January agreement, and they're now doing less than they were from the January agreement. The January agreement included the provision, for example, to provide 50,000 temporary homes for Palestinians so that they wouldn't have to live in tents. And again, that was just the thing that Israel agreed to and then just decided unilaterally that it wasn't going to do. And so there were none. They sent zero, right? Not a single one. And this whole time, obviously, Palestinians have remained in tents. So I think, you know, this was a real concern from the Palestinian negotiator side, as far as we've heard, in terms of how these negotiations went. And a key piece of it was that Trump himself guaranteed, you know, it was like the U.S. is going to put its weight behind making sure that Israel is actually implementing every detail of this thing. And they use that as a sort of like, okay, maybe that'll be enough to sort of push this in a different direction. But, you know, perhaps unsurprisingly, right, like Trump doesn't care about details, right? Like he's not, you know, he's not, he probably doesn't even know what's in this plan. And so Israel calculated, I think very correctly, that the United States wouldn't care and wouldn't get involved for like issues that they would consider to be on the margins, right? Like, okay, we promised 600, they're getting 300. Okay, well, there's still trucks coming in, right? And we promised there's rehabilitation of the infrastructure. Well, you know, at least there's aid. And so I think like making sure that there's sufficient kind of public condemnation of the ways in which Israel is reneging on this agreement already is actually a really critical thing in this moment, because the United States, who are the guarantors of this agreement, to some extent are feeling that political pressure, right? Like even within Trump's base, I think he's feeling pressure on the ways that the U.S. is continuing to back Israel to the hilt for absolutely no reason. So like, yeah, increasing awareness of what's going on with that and making sure people are aware that those violations are happening, right, is enough to hopefully do something to put some pressure on it to change it. And there's more power here than I think people realize that we have, right? In the same way that I think all of our griping about the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation effectively killed it, right? Like, it's gone now. And that's our doing, right, by raising these kinds of issues. And I think we have similar leverage here in making sure that those obligations are actually being met.
I'm glad you said that. And y'all, I'm not going to make it through the 20 points with Samer. And I know, because there's too much conversation. And actually, we get
pretty... Sorry, I keep yapping.
No, this is why we love to have you on the show. And I knew it was an ambitious, I knew that we were going to want to talk about other things. I am going to post the 20 points, y'all, in the archive of the show, and I'm also going to post it on my socials, both personal and political, because I think it's really important that people read that, you know, the devil is in the details. But to that point, I want to maybe have some conversation about Trump, but to that point, you know, I just got emotional. To that point, I'm not Palestinian, and I ain't got no Palestinian family or friends in Gaza. So what I think, as far as I'm concerned, and you know my politics, what I think don't really matter. I'm following the lead of the most impacted, right? So I see some folks, some very smart academic people, you know, sort of condemning the 20-point plan just wholeheartedly. This is a waste of time, yeah. But some of my Palestinian friends, right, who have lost people by the hundreds, family by the hundreds, excuse me, not just people. And I'll just name Linda because I can, Linda Sarsour in particular. You know, the line that's being towed, or the line, right, that I think that we're being asked to follow by some folks is, yes, be wary, right? Like, nobody has any illusions that Israel... got a moral barometer somewhere. And there's this sense of like deep, I was at the caravan on Saturday. Brooke Jenkins was there, by the way, and then I called her out on stage. But anyway. anyway, I digress.
You love to hear it. That's amazing.
What are you doing? I was like, I'm sorry, didn't I just get an email to tell you to drop the charges against the Golden Gate 26 and drop your restitution demand in your hand? I digress. There is some relief, right, that they're not being bombed as much. Like, there's some reprieve, some relief, and I really feel empathically that from very smart, fierce, you know, these aren't wimpy activists or organizers that say this. I've seen Linda stare down, you know, the state. And so that's part one. I want to hear what you think about that. And then part two really is attached to what you just said, which, because I'm trying to find the way I put it in my script. But I said even though something along the lines that even though we're weary and even though we know that Israel is going to continue to be Israel, the fact that we got here, the fact that Trump had to put out a plan to end this iteration of the genocide, the fact that in this 20-point plan, it does say at the very, 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 very bottom that maybe after all of the steps that happened, maybe we'll think about allowing Palestine to be a state. Is there room for us for Palestinians and their accomplices, of which I consider as what some person like, all right, here's some cracks that we can push to get to the next place, you know, the next place we need to be in the struggle for a free Palestine?
Yeah, that's a really wonderful question. And I think a lot of us have probably been thinking really deeply about that in these last few days. I think anyone who's watching this really closely and has been in this struggle for the last 2 years is feeling deeply mixed, right? How can you not? And I, you know, on its face, at the bare minimum, an end to like the kind of accelerated violence, the bombardments, the drone strikes, or even a deceleration of that, right? Even a reduction in the level of violence that was being, you know, inflicted upon Gaza City, for example, is critical, right? In this moment, after 2 years of this nonstop, the strangling off of aid, right? The constant internments, you know, terrorizing, the torture. Like, this is a huge development, and it's a really welcome and a really important one. Like, Palestinians need the room to breathe, and we need to, as a movement, prioritize that, right? Like, we don't get the right to sacrifice the Palestinian people on the altar of our like long-term strategic ambitions. You know, that their day-to-day lives in this moment are as important as anything else. And we have to hold the fact that, you know, this agreement obviously was not written by the Palestinian people. It wasn't even consulted with any Palestinian people. It was, you know, written on their behalf by a series of other people with a very, like, colonial perspective on, like, okay, this is what you're going to do, you 2 million people that have suffered so much. So it's not the agreement that we would have wanted. Right? It's that this 20-point plan is not something that's grounded in the lived experience of the people who have gone through this genocide. There's no question. At the same time, it's not a win for the Israelis, right? It's just not. The political climate has changed so much that that even the sort of, like, you know, very tip towards, you know, Netanyahu gets to, like, rewrite the agreement to his liking on some level, there's still constraints in which, right, I think there's some really important developments here. There are some critical things that are in this 20-point plan and some really critical things that are not. I think both of those represent both really important victories for the movement and really important opportunities for how we move going forward, right? Among them, the 20-point plan specifically refers to Palestinians' ability to stay in Gaza, the right to remain, and the right to leave and return, right? And that right to return is a remarkable development given the way things were going in terms of the sort of overt, explicit ethnic cleansing and forced displacement that has been the sort of modus operandi of the Israelis and the Americans for the past 6 months. At the same time, the agreement says nothing about the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. Again, a really big win, a critical one because of the role that they played in the ethnic cleansing campaigns. And the sort of recognition, even if, you know, as you said, a little bit ambiguous and a little far-fetched, of the Palestinian right to self-determination, right? That they do have those basic rights, right? As a people, as a nation. And these are really big developments, and I think open the path for how those get implemented in ways that actually can really positively impact the sort of broader trajectory that all of this is going to go on. You know, one thing we talked about in the Palestine Solidarity announcements this past week was looking at the various stages of where we go from here, right? So, like, okay, if we have in fact successfully managed to stop the hot war, so to speak, like the direct Israeli assault, okay, then, like, we found ourselves in the sort of stagnation period that, you know, it, unless something is done to get us out of that, invariably leads back to direct war, right? That's what we've seen in the sort of the cycle of events that has afflicted Gaza for the past 20 years. But if we can get ourselves out of that stagnation into some sort of like reconstruction and rehabilitation and the creation of a state, then we have to make sure that that's not done in a way that, like, you know, creates the neoliberal hell that I was referring to earlier, right? That's a really critical piece. And then even if we accomplish that, like, this has to be done in the context of accountability and truth and reconciliation, right? The, like, there needs to be consequences for 2 years of genocide aided and abetted by U.S. taxpayers. And if that doesn't happen, then we don't address the underlying material conditions that led us here. So it's a long road, right? It's not an easy road. And it, that requires us to hold complex truths. And among those complex truths is, you know, the ceasefire agreement is not what we want it to be. And we can welcome it, right? We can welcome the development away from the horror and carnage and grieve that we haven't found something better. And accept that, like, you know, this is our, these are like, this is our dialectic analysis, right? Like, this is the new situation we found ourselves in. We find the way to respond to it, to materially assess its weaknesses and where we go from here. And then, like, that's our responsibility going forward, right? Our strategic analysis has to be grounded in where we're at and not where we wanted to be.
Right, I'm Sam Moran. I'm just going to take the moment to point out, because my whole mission in life is to make more organizers. So you hear someone use the words dialectic and then followed by the word material or materialism, you're talking to an actual organizer. Makes my heart flutter. Samer, you look like you're somewhere where you're having a good time, so I'm going to let you get back to it. Looks like books and cocktails. And I want to thank you for taking time out to talk to us this morning. Look forward to seeing you soon, comrade.
Always such a pleasure, Kat. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.